Development Summit titled Organizing a Resilient Future, brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at pina.in. I'm Jesse, and I will be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the convivial Chris Smith, presenting on the topic of building scalable community permaculture orchards. Chris Smith is a permaculture designer, educator, and the founder and executive director of the Common Orchard Project, a nonprofit dedicated to transforming vacant lots across Greater Cincinnati and Cleveland into resilient, low-maintenance community orchards. Drawing from a rich background as a musician, community organizer, teacher, and agroecologist, Chris blends creativity and practicality in his mission to build ecologically diverse food systems. Since 2017, he has led the planting of over 20 orchards featuring apples, peaches, plums, cherries, Asian pears, and nitrogen-fixing black locusts, all tailored to site-specific conditions using permaculture principles. Through collaborations with local organizations, Chris activates underutilized urban spaces into hubs of food production and community connection. He has also played a key role in projects like the Camp Washington Urban Farm and is currently developing a multi-story permaculture orchard at Aberling Springs, a sustainable agri-community. A seeker and a builder at heart, Chris's work reflects an ongoing journey to turn raw materials into gold, creating systems that serve both people and the planet. Welcome, Chris. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Yeah, absolutely. Our pleasure. I really like how just part of your life and part of your bio includes like the musician side of things and the creativity side of things. I myself am a music therapist, so I am a big fan of that. And like weaving the arts into permaculture is a passion of mine as well. So I'm looking forward to how you weave these things together. I'm asking everybody the same question just to start with. Most people think of, if they think of permaculture and they don't really know permaculture, they'll think, oh, it's like a gardening thing or a landscape thing. But we know when we get into permaculture, it relates just as much, if not more, to like community dynamics. How would you talk to somebody, or what might you say about how permaculture applies to community development?
Well, I got my start in community development. I had the good fortune, and I'll explain some of this in the slides and presentation, working for a local nonprofit, a community development corporation, doing gardening and stuff with people in my neighborhood. So I just see them as inextricably linked. I have watched dozens of projects fail, not for sake of the agriculture or the biology, but because of the community, because of maybe a failure to power map and understand who has kind of an asynchronous amount of power in the room, and lots of choices like that. So when I teach students, I have a slide of when we teach invisible systems in permaculture, the difference of the visible systems is like a scale map of the earth, and the invisible systems is a scale map of the sun. Like the weight and effectiveness of invisible systems on a system. The visual stuff, that's minuscule compared to all those invisible workings, like how we relate to each other.
Perfect. Yeah. And you know, that's not just a pithy saying that permaculturists say, it's literally true. Like even in my personal fractal experience, the projects that I've worked on that have been most successful have really focused on how the community can stay gelled together. And the projects that have been maybe failures or just like fallen apart over time have been because we're all like gung ho about the physical structures, but there wasn't that like core group to like steward things into the future. So thank you for sharing that. And I agree. Chris, without further ado, I'll let you jump into your presentation. I'm really looking forward to it. I'll be in the background. If you need anything, just holler.
Great. Cool. Well, I'll jump right in and share my screen here. I'll also note that I am almost wrapped up with my own certification from PINA for permaculture education. It's been something, I think I started it like maybe seven years ago now. and one of those things that, you know, like growing a tree, it takes a long time.
Yeah, I'll just chime in that the diploma program for education specifically takes a long time because you have to teach a lot of PDCs. And that just, you can't do 20 in a year. Thank you, Chris, for being part of our program, and that your dedication to permaculture and professional permaculture in that way is awesome. So looking forward to learning more about that too.
Yeah, and I'll get into a little bit of history and stuff to start, but the kind of main, I do wear a lot of different hats in life, and kind of the main reason we're here talking about this is to take a deeper look under the hood of the Common Orchard Project. So that's the work that began in 2017. We're partnered with Green Umbrella, a regional sustainability, a regional climate collaborative here in the greater Cincinnati region. Helps us with the 501c3 kind of work, and also just connecting better with our broader community. So a little bit about the Orchard Project. A problem of communicating this is sometimes there's old like websites and trailheads that are not always maintained. So at this point, actually, we're up to more than 40 community orchards in the region. Like you mentioned in the intro, Jesse, we did some orchards up in Cleveland, and we still try to help those, but our focus now really is the greater Cincinnati region and trying to build out the infrastructure and the community connection there. And mostly we're friendly and we're like helping those folks continue those, but it was this broader plan that maybe will come back into fruition at some point. And you know, I get reached out, people from all over Ohio reach out to just help. We actually planted one in Springfield, Ohio last year and helped with a group from Bloomington to do that. So there's still like a lot of kind of tendrils that move around. But yeah, we grow and create this more compassionate, productive community. And it all started with vacant land. Particularly, it was a question of like, how can we re-envision the commons in our modern era? And how can we maybe not have that 100%? With land laws and all these kind of things, maybe a little tricky, but how can we move closer on the journey toward taking care of each other through collective land management? So that's what the Orchard Project is. It's these community orchards out in the region. We help install more. We help guide orchard stewards who maintain these orchards. And then we have a 2-acre, the Camp Washington Perennial Farm, as it's now being termed. Because that's our focus there, our perennial fruits, nuts, animals, a compost program. Yeah, and then we're partnered with Green Umbrella. It's actually the nation's largest regional climate team, termed as a climate collaborative over the past couple of years, but a more climate resilient future for the greater Cincinnati region. So a little bit more history. Like I said, began in 2017 with our first designed planting, and I'll talk a lot about that. That these are very intentionally designed through a permaculture process. I think a lot of people that see these in communities are like, "Oh, some trees and like some random things," but like each of the elements serves a very particular purpose to nestle into the goals of a collectively managed, community-oriented, volunteer-led organization. When you kind of pluck an idea out of its context and throw it down, like, you know, if you read something by Robert Hart, you know, you read some of these permaculture books and you just throw it into the middle of a vacant lot without doing that proper contextualization of the users and who will be interacting with that space, these things go haywire really quick. So I think that's a really important point, is that we intentionally designed this to be more resilient to the ebbs and flows of community volunteers who, God bless them, they are so very helpful to our work, but they also have lives and are not skilled permaculture practitioners who know every single weed and the timing and all these very technically difficult things that you learn over the years with permaculture. So then as we grew, I was basically patching together a kind of like a contracted nonprofit by doing small projects with the Port Authority in Cincinnati, Hamilton County Port Authority. So they had land bank money from the state where if a home was too far gone, they would tear it down. But really at the time, especially, there wasn't money or there wasn't the marketability to buy that land and, you know, build new. So I was coming in with some green infill money and adding more orchards to that. We still have a couple orchards that are a part of that program, but some of those, because of the timing, went back to neighbors, and one just failed entirely, and happy to talk about all the failures. I've tried to kill thousands and thousands of trees, and that was one site where I learned the final range of what it takes to fully kill a whole orchard. So it's good lessons like that. Usually that doesn't happen, but I was like, okay, we're gonna try and see if they survive, and they did not. But yeah, then in 2021, we partnered with Green Umbrella, and we've been planting about 8 or 10 plantings each year, except for this year. We've kind of taken a step back in 2025, and we are more focusing on stewards and volunteers and the education system, really making sure people have what they need to be successful. And then in here in 2025, we had a different person for a year and a half doing a composting program. Now they're a contractor helping us with a little bit of composting stuff, but we're a couple weeks away actually from hiring a farm manager, and that will be it's mostly been me that's the primary staff with some support from Green Umbrella staff like accounting, communications, grant management, visual aids, things like that. But for the most part, it's been me as a primary staff in those earlier phases, kind of as a contractor, holding this thing together, and then in 21 full time, and now we're hiring our second person. So just a little bit too of my background. Yeah, Jesse, like you said, theater and music, that was my undergrad, was in music composition. And right now I just feel way too busy with all of this stuff, and I really long to get back to a little more writing and a little more music. I taught voice lessons. That was like my primary gig for a long time. But then I read One Straw Revolution and reached out to Larry Korn and said, "Hey, who's doing this? How do you learn about this?" And he said, "Well, check, nobody's really doing it. So check out permaculture. That's kind of the closest thing." And so there happened to be a permaculture design course in Cincinnati in the next couple of months. And I was actually doing improvisational comedy at a coffee shop. And Braden Trouth came in and like posted a flyer to like the community board. That's how serendipitous and ridiculous all this was. So I learned about that, jumped on in, was able to be hired by Price of Will, this asset-based CDC, doing like being able to deploy immediately some of the things I was learning in the design course. Kept digging in, did my teacher training with Peter Bain and Sandy Cruz. And I would say doing the Forest Garden Design Intensive with Dave Jackie really took me as a designer to the next level. And I felt confident kind of walking into any field. I didn't include this on here, but the inspiration for the Orchard Project as it stands was doing the farm scale permaculture work with Grant Schultz in Iowa back in 2017, 2016. And there I learned about Stefan Sokowiak and the permaculture orchard and those kind of things. So I took a lot of that as design elements into the first orchard that we did. Common Orchard Project, but another thing that I do want to, yeah, I put it here, like I've planted 4,500 fruit and nut trees, and all of those to me, like it's not just planting them, it's managing them. These are all in managed systems. These are not, pine trees I planted out in the middle of a field and I'll come back and visit in 50 years. These are all inside managed systems. And one of the larger ones I'll show you about is my work with the Southern Ohio Chestnut Company. That's myself and my farm partner, Badger Johnson. This is one of two farms that we have currently. We're working on a third that will be kind of getting up and running next year. It's at a 100-acre nature preserve, and we've got about 25 of those acres in chestnuts, pawpaw, and wheat and other alley crops. A bit of a visual there of the whole site. Really excited about how this is growing. All these will be grafted pawpaw trees. We've got about half of them grafted so far. We could fill a book and talk forever on that, but just wanted to share a little bit about some of the other things. And obviously, that's just a very different management system. But how we planted this was again in community. We had about 50, 60 people out in the middle of 2020, spaced camping, spaced apart, masked up. And we got about 800 trees in that day on Saturday. And we've done community plantings every time. So we figure that reciprocity get there. The greatest compliment we got in that planting is one of our friends, Rachel, said, I've been a part of a lot of these kind of like community plantings, and I think these trees are actually going to live. I think you're actually going to care for them. And that is the goal. The reciprocity to volunteers who are helping us, for them to know that their work is not in vain, is huge. In the moment they feel it, they can sense the energy and effort you're going to put into the thing, and that enhances the gift that they are giving you. So the last kind of visual piece of like large farms, I kind of patched this together from some drone shots. This is an old shot, but this is a farm. It powers a lot of the Common Orchard Project's work. It's about a 2-acre site next to River City Correction Facility in the least treed neighborhood in Cincinnati, in Camp Washington, which is where the train yards are, and a major highway ripped through the neighborhood in the 70s. So there's an 8% tree cover in this neighborhood. It is rough. The only worse neighborhood is downtown, like is the actual, you know, concrete jungle of our downtown. So that's what we're doing, is we're trying to grow perennials, trees, and then run this composting program right alongside it. So that's what the compost program is. It's a skid steer operated hot composting system in concrete bunkers. And then we've been doing this great thing, which again, I would love to dig into. Bioreactors. We construct bioreactors in a very particular way, moving away from the single PVC chimneys to the multiple PVC chimneys to a single column of hardware cloth. It's a 2-foot diameter donut. It's shorter than the traditional Johnson Sews, just so people can actually reach in and volunteers can work with the thing. And these show up at most of the community orchards, because to me, the community orchard is kind of a base technology, and then you can tack on all the other little things you want. So if you have capacity to run bees on the thing, it's like, great, put them there. It was a, you know, a grassy field. Now you've got an orchard. Now you've got bees. Now you've got a bioreactor, and you can start adding things in at the end user's capacity. So, there's a couple of these that I might zip through, probably the varieties of trees that we use, but just some initial people considerations. If you are like going to be building your own orchard, yeah, start with that end in mind. And for us, that very first orchard that we planted, I had no idea who that person was going to be, you know? And sometimes you don't have the full version of, you know, you don't have a goal statement, you know, fully fleshed out, and that's okay. Get as far as you can. But for us, understanding the nature of vacancy in our city, like we're in Cincinnati, Ohio, Midwest, a lot of white flight, a lot of, you know, we were the 8th most populous city in the country in the 1880s, right? And it's just been shrinking since, because everybody's moving out to the suburbs. So I knew that the people that we were working with had a lot of transiency, but also had a lot of heart and desire to see their place as beautiful as it could be. So we started with all that in mind. There's a lot more on here. Of course, these would just be slides that people can kind of go through, take notes. It's kind of how I'm trying to design this presentation. But for us, we were trying to look at a scalable model that if we planted this orchard, we wouldn't max out the volunteers. So we were looking for anything that was low maintenance, biodiverse, of course, actually growing food, fruit trees that would result in food in people's mouths instead of, wow, cool tree. And we've learned a lot. I planted more plum there than I would ever recommend at this point in our bioregion. Plums are amazing. I had incredible luck with the first batch of plums that I planted. They fruited every year, and I didn't get another plum for 7 years after that. So they just get frosted out in our area so much. They're a vector for plum curculio and black knot and lots of other disease pressures. So I wouldn't do that anymore, but you live and you learn. I think this is really important, is defining stakeholders. And for us, our stakeholders are, of course, the orchard stewards themselves. And that's whoever pulls us into a site. I don't kick down any doors. I won't go in somewhere and say, y'all need an orchard here. Maybe a younger me would have looked at a vacant lot and gone like, there should be some fruit trees over there. And I had done some of that, like guerrilla planting, and all of those failed. All of those trees were destroyed, killed, died. I didn't come back enough. Yeah, you learn enough that's not the way to do it. And it might be like, you might roll the dice. You might get 10% of success there. But after seeing how that didn't work, we needed to redesign how we did this. So the first couple orchards I planted, I didn't have a training program. I was like kind of patching this thing together. I had money to plant the trees. That was it. And had to make money elsewhere, doing other things. So really, it wasn't until 2021 that we found more funding that I could actually launch a yearly training program. It's about 10 classes through the course of the year. We teach them every year. And stewards can come back as many times as they need to until they feel really confident in, say, pruning or the sprays. Or sometimes, for the first couple of years, there's not much work to do in an orchard. It's like pick the flowers off, make sure things are watered, a couple simple things like that. Apart from that, apart from those kind of core stewards, there's just always other volunteers and coming up with some kind of a system to, one of my favorite permaculture principles is catch and store energy. And if you don't allow for volunteers to give, then there's no opportunity for all those ancillary benefits. Like someone might be like, oh, I actually could mow here. And they'll just show up. But if they never were allowed to like give a little bit of their time, then they'll never realize that. So having kind of big volunteer days is great. The orchards that we install mostly have a lot of black plastic in them, and there's not really like as much need for giant mulching days or whatever. So it's actually like a challenge that we've created is there's not always a lot to do. Finding ways to connect funders is really important as well. I think some people start with a bit of a chip on their shoulder, like we're going to do this and we're going to do it all with no money. And I just haven't seen any of those survive longer than 5 years, any of those kind of intentions and programs. I'm not saying it's a bad idea or a bad intention, but I am seeking replicable systems and I just don't see them around. So I'm not super interested in trying to replicate something that doesn't result in 10 years of consistent effort that means people actually get to eat the food from these community orchards. That's the ultimate litmus test for me. I'm not here to plant trees. I'm here to grow food for people. And I do think that means you kind of at some point need staff or you need to pay people for their labor on this. And I know some programs that have patched it together and planted hundreds of really successful orchards, food forests, whatever you want to call it, that did so with like a robust team of scrappy volunteers and like one or two kind of part-time people, but those are so rare. Figuring out some of those things. All right, getting into the meat of it, some of the design considerations for how to build these. Because as a permaculture designer, I don't particularly care what you call the thing, if you want to call it food forestry, if you think of it more as community orcharding. Just to give some definitions to that, like all of these to me in permaculture, you can swap genes, you can call it whatever you want. And I try to blend these two things as much as possible. Community orchards, I would say that tends to veer more toward like linear rows of trees that are more legible. People go like, oh, that's an apple. It looks rather singular over there. There's not a whole bunch of other sprawly plants or pathways. And food forestry tends to look a lot more dense. And you can call it whatever you want. But to me, I'm more curious about what's in the center of these two things. And I think a lot of people plant food forests that will never feed a person. They'll feed a lot of squirrels, and that's great if that was your intention. But there's a great chart in Dave Jackie's book on caloric production of like deciduous forests and desert spaces and all this kind of stuff. And eastern deciduous forests put out a lot of calories, it's true. But like, do those calories show up on a plate for a human? And I'm not saying that humans are the most important creature on the planet. We are clearly a keystone species affecting a lot of change on this planet. And I think if we can engage, maybe evangelize a little bit, communicate the need for spaces to feed other creatures while feeding those people, we can get all these other benefits to the thing. So that's why my focus is feeding people so that they can see, oh, I can eat, and so can the bees, and so can the predatory wasps and other creatures. So a lot of what I do is as diverse as it can be, while as legible as it can be. So picking a good site is really important. Also, like you never know, like I planted trees after homes have come down, and just like how much work are you willing to put into like kind of restarting ecology in the soil? But if beggars can be choosers, then yeah, well draining, sunny, and near some kind of a water supply. The first 20 orchards that I helped plant, there was no water on site, and we live in a wet enough space in Cincinnati that that's okay. And if you orient some of these tree plantings kind of on a bit of a hillside, and particularly with these plastic tarps, I would basically anti-shingle them, so water would kind of catch from the tarp and flow in into the planting bed. That seemed to be enough. But we've been getting more spotty droughts, and if the goal, and it is for us, is food production, most fruit is made of water. So if at critical times you can irrigate and increase the poundage of food coming off of that tree and decrease the stress, then we should try to do that. So, as a lot of these are in more urban spaces, there is water nearby. Try to put it closer to water. And friends of mine at Denver Urban Gardens have to put water in. Like it's an absolute must if you are, growing fruit trees in Denver, not a question. So it all depends on kind of where you are. We are a pretty wet place here. The final thing I say here is designing right panel this school. This is a school orchard, like little sticks in cages. That's what this orchard starts out as. There was another space on the back end of the school that there was a previous garden, but it wasn't near any parking lot. Classes would never go past there, but it was just like kind of this tucked away spot. And they were like, oh, we could plant trees here. And I'm just like, no, not a chance. This needs to be seen. One of my favorite quotes is the best fertilizer is the farmer's shadow. And I think about that all the time. And it's not just the farmer, right? It's the school administrator. It's the funder. It's all of your stakeholders. Put it as in the way as you possibly can to those people, so that they also are like giving a little bit of attention. It could be really practical, like, oh gosh, I got to do this one task, or it hits somebody's attention at just the right time, and they're like, oh yeah, we need to organize a group out there, and we need to plant more. We need to call someone and get their support on this thing, or it's about to be destroyed. But you can't take away the thing that makes our front yard. You can't do that. So, trying to align yourself with those kind of interests as much as you can, which also means you have to make it look good. Crazy, sprawly. I think that has a place. A lot of permaculturists get out there and just plant all the trees in one day, all the plants, and it just looks crazy for years. And I've been around a lot of permaculturists who are like so belligerent about this, just like, but people just don't understand, and that's their problem. It's like, no, that is your problem for improperly assessing how anybody else works in the world. And it's fine if you want to drift off on a pile of driftwood into your own little lonely island, but I'm here to be with someone, and I'm here to make change happen. And it happens better if you're doing that with other people. And I needed to be convinced of this stuff. I needed to be brought in. And that's how I feel about all of our volunteers and all the people that we work with, is I want to take them along a journey and bring them toward, okay, now that you understand kind of how these plants play together and we're trying to provide for pollinators, cool. Can I take you one or two more steps down the journey? Some ideas for species selection, really a fruit and nut. I'll share a little later on just like some other herbs and things to include in this. We plant a lot of apple, European pear, Asian pear, peaches, pawpaw, jujube, persimmon, in our area. If you want an orchard that's like super resilient in the Midwest, it'd be Asian pear and pawpaw. And I've done that on some sites where I'm like, I'm kind of at initial site visit. I'm talking with somebody, and I'm like, they seem like they've got a lot of things going on, but they don't seem like they have capacity to add in something a little more complicated like apples, which have more pest pressure, more disease issues. There are great varieties we'll talk about, but I'm like, you know what? I think we'll get a lot of good out of some pawpaws and some Asian pears here. And oftentimes they'll just listen to whatever I have to say. Most people don't come to me, at least for these kind of orchards, with a shopping list of things they want. They just want it to go well, and they want fruit for their kids or the population that they're working with. I also try to add peaches into some of those. Peaches don't live super long in our area, or they succumb to more disease pressure over time. But they're one of the first things that are out. They will be fruiting in 2 or 3 years, and they're definitely the largest tree. They grow the fastest for us. So I'll often also put tomatoes into the black plastic or into the planting area. Just to train people, like, this is a place where food will come from. I know there's sticks in the ground right now, but eventually food will be here. So it's nice. Same with peaches. Like, peaches are the first fruit. So while you're waiting 5 to 7 years for your pawpaws, your pears, your apples, don't worry, more fruit is coming. I planted Chinese chestnut at one site, one school that had the space for it. So, I'm working on a native orchard as well of like some of the best grafted cultivars. This is for like a large, rather wealthy suburban school, and I'm excited that they're willing to pay extra for these like really nice cultivated native varieties of nuts and fruits and all these other things. Avoiding plum and disease-prone varieties, I think, is really important. I already mentioned kind of why we avoid plum these days, but your area might be different. Or you might just have to learn that. I'll show them about some varieties that are good for us, but this is honestly half the work of design is good genetics, whatever it is. If you're talking about herbs, shrubs, whatever, good genetics does the heavy lifting for you. And then it's going to be like, what are your cultural practices? Where did you stick them in? A couple of tiny things like, if it's root bound in a pot, did you tease those limbs out? Did you prune the roots, which I didn't know you could do, like when I started. So I think a lot of struggling trees that I've watched slowly dying or slowly unwinding their roots is just because they're root bound in their pots. You just get that sometimes. Okay, a little bit of variety talk. There's so much. I think there's lots of great apple varieties for our area. Like Jesse was saying in the beginning, I just planted about 300 trees. This is like another hat that I wear for this Agrihood, a sustainable community a little north of us in Cincinnati, up in Lebanon, Ohio. And there's a lot more varieties that we added to that have a lot more very specific purpose. But these represent like a good middle of the road spectrum of apples that are really disease resistant, taste good, like are worth eating, generally toward fresh eating, not just like really great if you make a cider out of it, but no one wants to eat it. Yeah, these kind of plants. So there's more on this list, and plenty more. I would say like Enterprise and Sundance here are like, if you can only pick two, would be great. But also, Pristine and Williams Pride, if you're looking for like an early thing, you do want to kind of match these up as best you can for pollination with apple, just because the pollination schedule is so diverse with apple. There's a lot more we'll talk about later about like kind of management and thinking through some of these things, but here are some varieties. I might, in the interest of time, just kind of like skip through these a little bit. Asian pear, honestly, any of them. I haven't had a bad variety. I find with Asian pear, though, they will succumb to several things, including I always get the word the sequence wrong. Apple cedar rust. They get rust, and fire blight comes after a lot of stuff. But I find as much reporting as there is on, like, say, Yoinashi is like really great at this, on this site, it doesn't do well. And Chojiro is very prone to XYZ, and on this side, it does fine. So, like, I think hill to hill, site to site, there is so much mysterious and unknown about this. And I, especially in the Midwest, I think our soils are so heterogeneous. Honestly, like, within eyeshot, you'll find different soil types that are significant enough to affect growth and resistance. So, like, honestly, just roll the dice. And if it doesn't work, try another. European pear, there's so much great pears out there, fresh right off the tree. More resistant to disease than apple, also pretty prone to fire blight for the most part. So finding stuff that is more resistant to that. peaches, same. Like I said, they don't live super long. And there's a couple others that we play with, like Saturn and a couple other varieties on here. You really do need to thin peaches, though. I'll just throw that out. You can't leave them to their own devices. They will break their bodies trying to grow a bunch of tiny peaches. Mechanical thinning in orchards is like taking chains, like a spinning set of chains, just to knock off flowers and fruit that's so like. At the home scale, at the community orchard scale, we're out there with hands doing this. Cherries, we don't plant a ton of cherries. They like things a little drier than most of our soils are able to get. But we do have some, and they're just really fun. I don't think they really do the work poundage-wise that the other trees are doing for feeding people, but so many people want them. And so I instead tend to plant, oh, it's down here, bush cherries. There's always some space on the site that works for more like edible landscaping style things. So even if kind of the main orchard is kind of in its own area, it's a great opportunity to plant things that kind of fit with the landscaping. So it might not be in like plastic or a kind of production mode, but there's always little pockets to place. You could call it like mini monocultures, right? Like a hedge of bush cherries. Jujubes are fantastic when they live. They really struggle in those early years, and it's expensive and hard to find them. Working on grafting these, I've not done any successfully yet, but we graft a lot of our own trees, all of our own apples at this point, and pawpaws, because pawpaws are so expensive to buy grafted. Fig, it's fun, but I think it goes in that same category as cherries. Like in our area, you just don't get a lot of pounds off of them, but a fresh fig is pretty seductive. Pawpaw, all of our orchards are grafted varieties. I think because they're smaller, intensive spaces, we're not playing the game of genetic rolling the dice and seeing how it goes. We're going to be intentional and graft everything. Obviously, not a final list of varieties here, but just sharing a little bit about this. Obviously, I'm a lover of pawpaw. We planted 1,000 of them right next to Pawpaw Festival in Ohio, in Athens, Ohio. That's where I don't know if I remember sharing that, but the Chestnut Farm Work, that's all around Athens, Ohio, on the southeast side of the southwest. Some other design considerations here, so. Obviously, genetics, that's so crucial. Get stuff that likes to live in your area. And buy the imported stuff. Like if you really love a Honeycrisp, that's fine. Buy it in the store. There's lots of them and they're pretty cheap. Don't grow a Honeycrisp. You will be a Honeycrisp's immune system. You will be its lymph nodes. You'll walk around being its kidneys. And you don't need to waste your time doing that. There's plenty of varieties that have their own that can provide for themselves. And depending on the rootstock that you're doing, and I won't give like a master class on rootstocks, but a lot of what we do are trees on 10-foot centers that are semi-dwarf. So things that get about just a little higher than is comfortable. So we're using like fruit pickers or prune or like pole pruners for some of that stuff. But not standard trees where the work of pruning a standard tree gets pretty intensive. And classically large standard trees, what you would do is you would prune them so you could walk up them. I don't think that's a great idea for volunteers who don't do this professionally. But also, we've been playing around more with dwarf trees. Obviously, you don't get as much fruit from them, but we've been doing some more staking and supporting and doing what are called high density or tall spole programs. And that's with very specific sites that are ready for it. And that's maybe a little more traditional orcharding. We're putting a lot of variety onto that by adding herbs and other things into the base. And we're still using the holistic spray program that we use. But that maybe is starting to look a little more conventional. And we're doing that at like a high school, like an ag tech high school in Cincinnati. So folks who are like going into maybe not agriculture, but they are being exposed to lots of agricultural or industrial ways of thinking for different parts of the workforce. Maybe some of them will go into agriculture, would be great. But maybe the other just like conservation work. So we're trying to incorporate that into that space. But again, that's because we know our stakeholders, we know our users there. I wouldn't do that everywhere. Just some notes on where to source trees. I get most of my trees from Cummins Nursery in Ithaca, but Schlaubach in Medina, New York is also really great. They're Amish. You have to write in and get a printed catalog. And there's plenty of others. I mean, Adams County Nursery, Stark Brothers, so many others that are great. But those are some of my favorite, mostly because Cummins will actually tell you what rootstock it is. And for me, that's really important information, especially if some don't work in our area over time. Okay, here I think is the crux of the design idea. To me, I see two main patterns in community orchards. And I will say too, while I'm thinking of it, I was able to get out to Martin Crawford's space in England a year or two ago, and he's establishing lots of food forests on, 4 to 6 acre spaces, kind of blocks. And something he was doing that I thought was brilliant is he was planting the woodies into a grassy field and doing nothing else, like not planting any other herbs and all the other stuff. So planting the trees and just letting them grow for like 5 or 6 years. And I think that's great. I might adapt that and like might put a plastic square right around the base of the tree, or like a mulch ring or something like that. But instead of planting 100% of the species right away, let the tree get to a state where it's actually producing some shade underneath itself before you start complicating the space and making it really hard to weed around the base of the tree, because you have to fight through all the plants you just put in that are all like first year, barely large, and the sod that exists on site has had ample time to, be gigantic. But I call these ideas like tree islands, like a single tree, in the middle of grassy turf. And that's kind of what conventional orcharding is. And I don't tend to do this. I only do this really if it fits in with existing landscaping. Like some school already kind of have arboretum style tree islands around mulch rings. So if it goes with the culture of a space, and I know somebody is going to just like see this new tree that was added and incorporate it naturally into their mulching program, then I'll kind of like dovetail that. I think you can also still put lots of like herbs around these things. Daffodils, yarrow, comfrey, lots of other stuff kind of in that ring space. And then you can also like put a nectary garden near it, in kind of a box or a garden space. So you can still get a lot of the same effects of what I tend to do, which are a little more complicated. Here's one. This is an orchard out in Kansas City. This is with our partners at Giving Grove, helped plant this tree islands, right? Little circles. It's a grid. An advantage to this is it's super legible. Like this is my profession. I know about this professionally. I am attentive to it because it matters to me. I don't expect that from everyone else. This is complicated work, learning the specific needs of not just an Asian pear versus a European pear, but like a Yoinashi Asian pear versus a Potomac European pear. Like it takes time to learn all those things. So I think organizing a space so that it's not overwhelming to volunteers or even to, professionals that are there, will lead to a lot more health for the trees. So I think there's a lot of advantage to this. And also it can go really wrong. These are these like kind of lollipop apple trees. I see this really commonly. You can see this is an abandoned orchard up in Cleveland. Grass right up against the base of the tree. There's a lot going wrong in my opinion on this. So what we try to do are more polycultural designs. Obviously, it's more complex. There's more weeding to think through. And there's a lot less weeding if you're doing plastic or cardboard and mulch, those kind of things. But I honestly see probably too much cardboard and mulch in lots of plantings. And I think same like in permaculture, everybody, at least in the Midwest and other wet places, started to realize that like swales weren't a good idea most of the time. Or like maybe in the 90s, everyone was like doing herb spirals everywhere. And then people were like, wait a minute, what? How about I just grow next to that space? And there's plenty of space. I don't need to be vertically integrated. This is a lot of extra work for not all that much extra plant or like useful material. I kind of view cardboard and mulch kind of in that same family of maybe a little bit overused. It's definitely not as toxic as other potential overuse things. I mean, like wood chips are free. Get them out there. They're going to be eaten by all manner of stuff and really benefit these spaces. But just the sheer labor of applying it and moving it around and coordinating and dropping, chip drop has like destroyed many a front yard. So it's a little difficult. So we use plastic a lot. We'll use painter's plastic from Home Depot, 6 millimeters thick. I've had it on orchards for 10 years. And well, 8 years, and it's not the only thing that tears it is a mower. But the sun and other things is not really destroying that. It's not fraying off. It's not, well, this isn't like a thoroughly vetted scientific opinion, but I think it's much less becoming microplastics as like a string trimmer would create microplastics. I think there's a lot of other more dangerous vectors for microplastics than this particular brand of plastic. Anyway, sorry, a little rant there. What we're doing with these polycultures, we're looking for mutual support guilds, relationships between plants, insects, animals, all that kind of stuff. I think guild, I don't mean to get off on a rant on guild, but guilds to me are the nature of relationships. And a polyculture is the kinds of species on the site. So there's lots of ways that these plants can relate to each other, and we just want to make sure all the niches are filled in as many niches as can be filled. We're trying to do that. We're trying to grow our own fertilizer. So like Jesse said, we'll use black locust or sea buckthorn, though I'm moving a lot more toward Amorpha fruticosa, false indigo bush or indigo bush. There's a lot of names for it. Mostly because planting your own fertilizer, I think it's a question of scale. And in spaces where I can only get like 10, 12 fruit trees in, I think I'd rather have the fruit trees. And I'd rather a human come around and apply like a Revita nitrogen-based fertilizer, compost by hand in those spaces instead of using that critical real estate for a tree. However, planting black locusts, especially in like recently devastated spaces, they love it. And not just the nitrogen fixation, I think that's a great advantage, but also what I see is like kind of a quick highway being formed for mycelial networks. And arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi is so critical in forming soil structure, especially after it's been devastated and just flattened. So for all of those tree roots, the fruit tree roots to make their way, they kind of need as fast of a soil structure to be created as it can be. You do still have to contend with grasses, but you can use plastic or clumping plants to form a border, like a moat, a hedge against those grasses. So yeah, this is kind of what that looked like. That the very first orchard, this is what we did. really critical mistake I made is I planted, if you can see that in the bottom of the screen, that's passion flower. In its very first year, a young peach tree right next to passion flower. A month later, this peach tree was engulfed in passion flower. This is where thinking successionally is really important. And maybe just the plastic for the first year, who knows? At the time, I could only, like, I had the money and I just had to go and do it all in one moment. But yeah, there's like wormwood in here and betony and some kind of mint in the back, maybe boneset, stuff like that. So this is about what it looks like. This particular orchard, I was able to design on grade or on contour with the kind of shape of the land. So there's no irrigation out here. And these have been wonderfully productive trees. They've shown more growth really than any other community kind of fruit tree planting I've seen in the area in those first 5 years. This is kind of what it looked like in year five from above. As you can see on the very bottom, that row that's kind of half in shade, that's all aronia berry. And strangely, in these kind of urban spaces, a fire engine flipped over into the orchard just a year or two ago and crushed most of those aronia berry. So like it was a bit of a buffer. It was a bit of a visual hedge to like have a berry, but also it's like a beautiful tree, as a beautiful bush on a very major road in town. So like I viewed that space as a buffer, kind of buying us forgiveness. And I'm glad I didn't lose trees to that fire engine. But yeah, like you can see, this is just in the middle of a neighborhood. It was two residential properties that came down. We've actually got a lot of space. We can add more trees if we want to. But that's the start of the thing. So there's a bit, just a bit of a visual for this. Again, this is very different than like, you know, I'm going back to Robert Hart a lot, but like these very food forests that really mimic forest successional patterns. Primarily, like a design limitation on us is we've got to mow the lawn. We live in a city, there are laws and regulations, and I know so many permaculturists who just like, get dinged with, you know, long weeds or whatever, which I think is maybe a difficult, it's maybe not a failure, but like the work of being a good neighbor and connecting with the diversity of people who may not understand your vision can undermine a lot of projects. And I just didn't want to mess around with it. I wanted to take it off the table. It's not a fight I want to fight. There's plenty of other places to be angry at the Department of Making You Sad, various city enforcement departments. This thing needed to scale, and it needed to work with people. Also, mowing the lawn, it was already happening. This one, I would love to not mow the lawn. You know, we all love to rip out our lawns, but when I mow the lawn, it's visually really appealing, and it makes the orchard pop. And I think it makes it more legible so that people can go like, oh, what's happening here? Oh, I see fruit trees, but there's something else happening. There's all these other plants, and it pulls people in. And then we can have the conversation about native pollinators and predatory wasps and pest cycles and how we could get away from conventional sprays if only we had a more diverse environment for pollinators to exist in. This is a little of what some of these like in their first year. We had plastic on for a year and took it off. So it could just be a temporary thing while you allow your herbs to kind of fill out, and then you take the plastic off, moving on. Also, real quick, I ran numbers about like the carbon in this plastic, and it's literally just the pounds of the plastic. Like it's you'll burn more carbon into the atmosphere by mowing the lawn than you will by having this plastic. Nobody wants to add more plastic into our world. But for me, if it's the difference of having no orchard and having an orchard, I would rather put the plastic in and get the orchard in. But you can take it out and move to something else. And then we did this other thing that's really interesting on the top right, where I took like decking material and kind of used it as like a clapboard so that we could get a clean edge with mowing. It was definitely an extra expense, but that was at a particular orchard at a school where the school administrator was like really concerned with things looking a little unkempt. And I'm like, I don't want to have any, I don't ever want to go out to this orchard and have a fight with this principal. Like, I don't have time for that. I don't have time for it. So I'm going to make this like super pristine and nice for them. And then they fill out. This is one we did up in Cleveland, full of like, this looks a little crazy in the photo from my phone. But there's all this kind of stuff, all this diversity here. And then it's still able to be mown. So I feel like this is a bit of a bridge between folks who want to, plant all the crazy diversity. You still get it, maybe a little bit less. It's a compromise where you can still play nice with the city and code enforcement, but you still get a lot of the benefit of the various diverse plants in the system. Speaking of those, these are ones that we often use. I don't know if folks can take a screenshot or whatever, but this is obviously not an exhaustive list. It's just ones that we continue to add in. There's so many more that you could add to this. I think I have some bolded ones because I think hosta and sweet Sicily are great for mature trees to kind of form a uniform mat, which can sometimes be aesthetically really great, but also does like the job of being a hedge against grasses. My friend Dean in St. Louis has done like research on edible hosta varieties. He's like actually tested some of these. I wish I had some on the tip of my brain, but there are more. They're edible, and then there are tasty hosta varieties. Like many of our permaculture plants, edible is a very loose term. It won't kill you, but why would you bother? Yeah, so a lot of these have multiple functions, and yeah, you can add in as many other things as you want. Some maintenance considerations to talk through. So a lot of my training and the orientation that I had from one of my teachers, Michael Phillips, who unfortunately passed away a couple years ago. Michael was an incredible practitioner and knew the ins and outs of every product he used. So while I don't expect orchard stewards to do literally everything that Michael was doing as a professional apple grower, I'm trying to soften the edges and streamline some of the protocols that Michael worked on, or pick up the slack. So we will make a large batch of plant extract each year and then distribute that to stewards. So I don't expect them all to to know how to make their own plant extracts, but we can do that collectively in one spot, and then the work still really is distributing it. Like people gotta drive in, we gotta move it around. It is still work. But the five kind of main tenets that he talks about over and over for good orchard maintenance, which I would say is true of any other food forestry, not just like the production of apples, but any native trees, any kind of trees. Remineralizing the trees to maximize photosynthesis. There's a long tirade we could go on, but really, I think that's our role as stewards of these spaces is allowing the trees to hit a more maximal amount of photosynthesis and able to convert more sunlight into energy through proper balancing of minerals. I don't expect stewards to do annual soil tests. So a lot of our guidelines and recommendations are just like, middle of the road, you're doing some good. It might not be optimal, but it's better than nothing. We want to create these conditions for outrageous diversity, hence all of the polycultural plants, diversity in blossom time and providing nectary sites for pollinators, all that kind of stuff, but also outrageous diversity to outcompete disease. Marcinia is a newer apple concern. Pretty sure that's how you pronounce it. And for a lot of lower spray orchards, it seems to be a problem in low spray or organic orchards when it's a very conventionally arranged just turf and tree orchard. I don't know exactly why that is, but I think there's a lot of active capacities, particularly that mushrooms and mycelial formations have for trees. Hence why we are good fungal stewards, because at the end of the day, these are food forests. They tip a little more toward mycelially dominated soils. So that's what we're trying to accelerate away from the turf that was existing on the site. We're trying to, instead of drop a, you know, a nuke on the space with chemical sprays, we're trying to create competitive colonization. So we're trying to, you know, colonize certain areas. We are carpet bombing very small spaces, whether that's the exact fruitlets or some of the leaves, depending on what kind of pest pressure. So I think one example of that is, say, Plum curculio is a real persistent pest that'll get pear, apple, plum, obviously. But it's a real big problem in our area, and you know, apple moth, like calling moth, lots of other pests. But what you can do is spray Kallen clay, a powderized clay product, on the fruitlets. It'll annoy. It won't perfectly keep the females off of every single fruitlet, but it will annoy them enough that if they can find one elsewhere that doesn't have it, so you can use a trap tree, say underneath or with chickens underneath that tree, just little sharks circling, just waiting for those fruitlets to fall off. So if you colonize the trees that you're trying to grow food for and don't touch the trap tree, all of those fruitlets will drop down to the chickens and they'll eat the fruitlets. So little strategies like that that we can identify. And at the end of the day, we're here trying to support tree immune function. Like I said before, I don't want to be the entire immunity of the tree, but I will need to be some of it if my goal is actually producing food. As far as like maintenance is concerned, to me, this is more important than, like, I know we spend a lot of time on design, and as young fruit tree growers or tree growers, most of our experience will be planting trees. And, you know, it takes time before you've cared for something for 10 years. But at the end of the day, this, it seemed like that visual of invisible structures, invisible. This is the sun. This is the most important thing, is like, what cultural practices are you engaging in to take that planted tree and turn it into food for people? Orchards, fortunately, and food forests are long-lived. Like, I think there is still truth to that adage of, you know, it's less work over time. I think there's a lie in that. And I tend not to tell people it's less work. I'll say it's a different kind of work. This space is differently managed than, say, a community garden space. Particularly, I convince a lot of volunteers, because a lot of the work is upright. It's not you bent over on your hands and knees chewing weeds with your teeth. There's a lot less work to do in August and July, when it's just the hottest and worst time of the year, where most community gardeners are done. They totally flake on the garden in those months, and I don't blame them. But once an orchard is a little more mature, those are the best months in the orchard, because you've got some shade and you can just kind of hang out, and you're spot checking, you're looking at stuff. You've done most of your work in the cooler part of the year. So I do think it is seductive for good reason, and also can be frustrating when you can't diagnose various pest pressures. So we'll talk a little bit about that. What the work is of taking care of these kind of things, of course, it's the actual planting itself. And really, at the end of the day, it could just be pruning, dormant pruning, and harvest. Like, it could be as simple as those two things. And I think a lot of folks that are trying to do permaculture around their house are like looking for those wins. But if you're wanting to grow more food or more kinds of food, the work does get more complicated, right? So it might involve sprays in spring. Can't remember if I've got a slide describing that too much, but holistic sprays from Michael Phillips are neem oil, effective microbes, and fish juice or fish hydrolysate. Also, I think spraying in Kallen clay and a couple other products like BT or spinosad at certain times to limit coddling moth and other pests. Very targeted, right? This isn't spraying these things all over. It's just at the stuff that's eating our food. But we let those creatures live. We don't, you know, chase down and murder every single Plum curculio in the world. Anyway, But also there's like nutritive sprays that we could be doing, adding a lot to the soil ecology as well as the aerial parts of these plants. If you want to grow fruit and eat, and it'd be worth your time, thinning the fruit is pretty important. Some trees, like say jujube, you don't need to thin much. That's their point. They just throw out a ton of smaller fruits. But I think you could also thin those. It's all relative cost benefit. I don't push this too much on stewards. But some are up for it, and some really want to like grow immaculate, wonderful fruit for their neighborhood. So that's some of what it looks like. Obviously, there's more that you could stitch in here. But it does take work. Like, it isn't a no maintenance system. Anyone who tells you that has not eaten or has not sold anything from their orchards. though even saying that, there's this these amazing peach trees at a really old historic planting in Cincinnati that did great with no maintenance for like 20 years. And it was just like, I've never seen that repeated. So I'm not saying it doesn't work, but it's very difficult to replicate. You likely won't repeat that. So in lieu of hoping and praying that you're going to be that lucky devil who just never has to care for these trees, we're trying to set up systems that make more of these things happen instead of, well, just roll the dice and maybe you're that lucky person. And the survivor bias of observing, well, this orchard works really great from this, it's like, but you don't see the 20 that failed and they did the exact same thing. So that I think is a real key part of a scalable system. Maybe just another visual of what some of this like yearly calendar looks like. Pruning, spraying, thinning, some more pruning, and then harvest. And really, ideally, the work of doing this is the work of harvest. That's what you want to get to. And that's a pretty magical thing when it feels like, wow, all I did was I mixed some ingredients, I sprayed some trees, I pruned stuff in the winter. That was pretty easy. That was like cool, not hot work. And now I'm out here under the shade of this tree, upright, standing, picking fruit. That's what we want to get to. Just some real quick bits about pruning, just because there's so many great. Oh yeah, this is a leftover from a Unity Gardens workshop, this slide, which they're partners of ours up in South Bend, Indiana. I teach whole workshops on this. There's a lot to go into. But I think the simplest way of thinking about it is apple and pear. You're looking for a central leader, so a straight trunk with drooping limbs. You want fruit tree limbs don't want to be like this. They want to be down. If they're up too upright, I'll do this as best I can on the visual of Zoom, like their limbs will snap, just like your elbow joint. Not exactly like your elbow joint, but the visual gets communicated. Finding a way to thin out, keeping that leader going, and then just think of like, how can I pull these branches down? And you don't need many of them. You don't need many of those side branches. Trees are braced for chaos in their world. They grew up in a place where mammoths could just completely tumble, 100-foot tall trees. I watched a video just recently of like an elephant totally ripping down this like 60-foot tall tree. There's still animals capable of doing this. And they had giant sloth, and giant beaver. So they're ready for anything. But we are here as orchard stewards, as caretakers of these spaces, to say, hey, it's okay. I got you. I'm not going to let a giant mammoth come and totally destroy you. I'll put up some deer fencing, I'll put up some caging. But I am going to take some of the limbs because you are braced for any possibility. And I'm here to say, like, nope, those possibilities likely won't happen. I'm here to make sure you grow more fruit and the tree's there to grow more seeds, right? That's its goal. It wants to photosynthesize, to have a bunch of redundancy, and to propagate itself, right? To share seeds with the world. And I've got a couple different goals as a fruit tree grower. So for those reasons, I think it's important to prune so you actually get food from the space. A lot of gooey, terrible photos of the need for integrated pest management. So really some of what this work is that attention that you pay to an orchard, the farmer's shadow, right? If you are just out there looking and inspecting fruit, you can start to identify what's going on. A lot of trapping, if you buy commercial traps, most of that is not designed to stop pests. It's just designed to inform the orchardist what's happening. And there are some traps that you can create that do limit pest pressure. But I think the best lesson that one of the best lessons I got from Michael Phillips was this is a person who's, articulated a lot of these protocols, and there's still pest pressure in his orchard. And some years are worse than others. And I saw plum curculio damage on some of the fruitlets. And it's like his knowledge of the rhythms of that system and being okay with some damage, not all, not 100% loss of crop. You don't want to get there, but being okay with a little bit of pest pressure as an indicator, or like, oh, the first couple of fruits got hit, but then, the slower, more methodical, holistic systems that we're employing took effect and stopped that pest pressure. But it also didn't completely obliterate the ecology and start succession back at ground zero. So that's kind of the work that we're doing. There's a really great, I'll go right down here, Giving Grove's field guide. You can go here, Giving Grove. They're a national network of community orchards, and there's a great book on community food forests out there. But Giving Grove has been kind of working more intentionally with a bunch of cities, and there's more that they're trying to kind of bring online. We were an earlier group in that, and our program was a little different because we already had it kind of up and running, but it wasn't like it needed a lot of formation. So I've really appreciated some of their work. But their field guide is just a really friendly approach to some integrated pest management issues for these kind of crops, for these kind of trees. And that's the difficulty part of this is like IPM, integrated pest management papers from universities. Like, what community, what volunteer wants to read through 30 papers that isn't really even tooled for their approach to management afterwards? So I think this is what we need in trying to scale more of this is we need to do our own research and have our own set of recommendations that are tested, that work, and that admit when they don't work or profess the limitations of it. So I think it's a great tool. They were told at a time that they had to like, they were like, we're going to build an app. And then it was like the app every site that just gives you some recommendations of what to do. So that's where I would go right now if you were having some of these issues in your backyard or at your community orchard. So Orchard Project has a ton of really great information out there, and they are a fantastic group who have been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. I would just get on their email list. Anybody can sign up. Again, a lot of what we're doing is planting these polycultures to provide for lots of different things like bats, bees, birds. Little hack for bats, like they need long water. I don't know if that's an appropriate term, but like a little bucket of water, not enough runway, right, for them to grab. Just something to think through. And maybe they get it in urban places with all of our box cutters that are completely clogged and full, but just something to provide. Just a couple things that I wanted to sum up with, because I mean I've been doing permaculture now for God, studying and learning about it for 15 years, and there are a whole bunch of things that I've seen that have gone wrong, and I still do call myself a permaculturist. I don't have too much of a problem with that word, but I do find myself in conflict with some practitioners and people who speak about this. And I see sometimes that like as we're building this the momentum of this work, sometimes we speak without actual lived experience of the possibility of a thing. And as a storyteller, like I'm okay with that to some degree. And then there's also just like some snake oil to be sold. And we do need to be careful of people who've have a survivor bias. Like, this is the only way to do this. It's like, well, you had a particular set of conditions. So trying to repeat this success is my goal. So some big failures that I see in new food forests is that people don't add durable labels to the trees. They make little metal forestry tags. There's a much better one that I use. These are a DP Industry forestry tag, and it's a much thicker metal. I would go with that. Also, I don't have a visual of this, but the garden marker by Artline. Those are great garden markers. Go with that. I've had those out on trees for 3 or more years, and they've don't use a Sharpie, you know, like this will persist. What I'll often do is after a planting, and mind you, these are in rows, so it's a little easier to describe this. I'll do a voice to text, and I will just read out, and I'll say like, you know, like Western row of trees from north to south, and I will just read every single tree into a text document, so that I have like basically two or three different maps, like a verbal map, a visual one, and then the trees themselves that are holding some of that information. I hope that is helpful to someone who's about to do a new planting. Often people never trees, and I think even the native trees could stand with just like a tiny bit of shaping in early years. And it's precarious to learn how to do this. Like I understand the concern for not wanting to kill the tree, not wanting to hurt the tree. These trees, again, are brought up in a world of chaos. You definitely won't kill it. So what I tend to do is when I teach pruning classes is that we will prune on Bradford pear. So if you want to take a book, like even if you aren't in a pruning class, but go do a pruning class somewhere or online or read about it, and then prune some Bradford pears, you will feel no guilt about hacking away at that thing. And it actually tends to form like a pretty good fruit tree. Most Bradfords do like a pretty good central leader. And so you can learn a lot just by practicing on Bradfords. I think one of the biggest issues I see are grasses near the base of a tree. If you see that, you need to change the culture that's happening that allows that. And I get that like we're all maxed out on time. No one has time to care for some of these things. And to me, the compromise I make is I put plastic down. I find that the plastic allows for the seasonal ebbs and flows of people's time commitments. Like it's a busy time of year, all year. Kids are just getting out of school. Like that volunteer that thought they would have time just picked up like a Saturday volunteer day doing something else, and they're gone for 3 months. Like who knows? But when they come back, I don't want them to have a mountain of work. I want them to have a little bit more to do, hence the compromise with plastic. Or even just like a plastic skirt around a tree for a couple of years, I think will help. What we tend to do is plant trees in the fall. Bare root trees that are shipped in the spring, we'll pot them up. And it's great, like for the cost of the material to plant in the spring. But I have seen trees that will grow 50% larger in the summer if they were planted the fall before instead of the spring of. So they grow a lot of roots under the ground. They get really seeded into their new space and are already starting to transition and, you know, make that connection with their local soil community once they get planted in the fall. So we love to do that and then place a tarp down. And then the following spring, we'll plant herbs and stuff between the tarp. Not saying you have to do that, but if you do plant in the spring, you might want to give some other things more time or give a little extra care. Or if you have the ability to like prep and do some cover cropping or something like that, that's amazing. There's a lot we could go on that route, but yeah, there's so many people that just with how this work works, we finally get permission and we line up the paperwork, which that takes forever. The permissions, the leases, the property, all that kind of stuff, that as soon as we get permission, we want to go. So if you can, just hold back even another year. You're gonna be there for 10 years. Like you're gonna see this thing to fruition for 10 years. to me, sometimes what's another year? And I totally get it. Sometimes I need to rush it too. The idea of not accounting for local variation in your climate, seeing something cool on Instagram, plucking it out of its context and throwing it down where you are, just be ready to contextualize that. That is, I think, the work of a good permaculture design course, is it teaches you how to critically think through how to shift environment and microclimate. And there is a breadth of experience that's out there. And if you can't learn to read between the lines of why that practitioner was successful, then it's going to be really hard to pull it into your own space. So I'm not even saying anything that I do, you should necessarily do. I'm trying as best I can to kind of speak between the lines so you can see why what I do may or may not work for you in your context. This is a big thing, misunderstanding the power map of your area when choosing a site, getting kicked off of a lease. The Camp Washington Perennial Farm, that has been in existence since 2013, and it's next to a correction center. It's owned by the county, and we have a 5-year lease that we just renewed for another round. A main reason why I picked that, and there were other offers of like, yeah, come here, do this thing. We would love to have you farming our land. I'm sure folks on this webinar get that a lot. Please farm our land, and we'll kick you off as soon as it's convenient to us. No, thank you. If there's an asymmetry of power, be really cautious of that situation, and there usually is. Woodcock, that's a lease situation, but there's really a symmetry of power. It's a small nature preserve run by like a volunteer board, and we believe we're providing enough value for that. And we have a 75-year lease. But at the end of the day, I've watched leases that are ironclad be disregarded by landowners. And as long as that person has more money to pay for lawyers, they will win. So make sure you are more evenly matched. And for me at Camp Washington, I think it's highly unlikely that space is going to become luxury condos anytime soon, right next to a correction facility. So that's like trying to pin yourself against certain higher power structures, and just look at their incentives for like, well, who could even possibly take this land away from me? And there's a lot, I mean, anything can happen in the world, but we've had the county commissioner out to celebrate the composting that work that we're doing. So even though my goal there is a nursery for the orchards that we help and demonstration site, the composting program has actually given us a lot of political power in our area to continue to be allowed to exist. We're actually going to get ready for like another round of like doing some concrete work and driveway and some other more user-friendly things that the composting work is affording us. In closing, just a couple other secret missions I like to talk about. So, community development-wise, I've talked a lot of like technique in this about like how to place these things. But to me, that's all. Once we get through that, then we can do the real work. And the real work is connecting neighbors to each other. I find that this quote I think about a lot, this Saint Antoine d'Exupéry quote, I find love is less looking into each other's eyes as it is looking out into the sun, or looking out together. I'm butchering it now. Looking out in the same direction. And I think that's what it is to love our neighbor, is looking out in the same direction, finding something to do together, and putting ourselves to that thing. Instead of let's just sit at another meeting and talk about the difficulties of our neighborhood. We can do that too. It's probably going to happen. But I think people get much more excited about the solving of issues, the doing of something together. And my hope, my secret mission is people who don't get to talk to each other, people who are enemies on Facebook, you know, they're regularly conditioned to find difference to each other, can find in these spaces some similarities and some mutual desires. And I think from that place, they can start to build a relationship, which usually looks like seeing each other at the grocery store and then seeing each other at the coffee shop 7 times, 7 more ways. And then eventually they go like, oh, this person isn't so evil, even though they have a couple different opinions than I do. I've said it a bunch, but yeah, increase ecological literacy. I think we make some mistakes sometimes by scatter blasting an area. And while it's impressive and ecologically diverse, nobody else who doesn't have, you know, the experience that that practitioner had, no one else can read what's going on, and no one else is brought along for the ride. And I want to create spaces that are step ups in ushering people deeper into this work. And one of the other final missions that I have is, yeah, a practice of the commons. Even just exploring how difficult it is to manage spaces collectively, giving other people that experience, giving that for myself. I'm still learning a ton about what to do and what to not do. Apart from just, oh, I just need more money, I just need more time or whatever, throwing my hands up. But what social technologies do we have to develop to redo what we had in a past era? And not that all those things in the past era were great, but there are some things I think we want to pull into the modern era. And yeah, secret, not so secret mission is actually growing food. I don't particularly care for the ribbon cutting of we just planted 100 trees. I'm like, talk to me when you're eating on those trees. And of course I will celebrate and clap for new tree plantings. But yeah, that is my goal here. Last bit, and then I'll let y'all go. Or we'll ask a couple questions or think about that. I think really, apart from some of the techniques we've talked about, equipping orchard stewards to have all they need to succeed. And that maybe that's supplying the materials for sprays, teaching them. But I'm learning that it's a lot of like, I think people are just like scared about hurting the tree. So they'll come to the class, but they won't prune. And so I'm trying to do a little more clinic model where I'll go to an orchard and I'll invite anybody else who's able to show up on that day. But I'm there to handhold a little bit and just reassure someone that it's going to be okay. So if you can offer that to each other, we have a couple like kind of core stewards who kind of shop them around to lots of different orchards, like kind of like a bigger buddy kind of thing. So I think over time that kind of tiered experience system will evolve, and I'll be able to route people and go like, hey, can you go help this newer person with this thing? They really just need some assurance about that. But yeah, actually doing that networking of people within the network, that's really critical. Plastic, I can't advocate for it enough. I know I feel a particular problem about it, a tension there. But when I look around at how fast the trees grow because of limited competition with grasses, because of, I don't know, ebbs and flows of volunteership. When I go to prune or weed an orchard, which happens a lot, I'm like, oh, thank God, it's only like 10 weeds I have to pull instead of 900. I'm more likely to show up the second day. And so are volunteers. They get burned out just like weeding Bermuda grass and all these things every single month. We're not here to create menial tasks for people. We want them to be dedicated to the high value work of harvesting food. Yeah, and I think what happens in a yearly work with a network like this is you have these like big pulses of energy. You've got like a yearly plant distribution, these like compost and nutrition, like you've got these pulses of things. It's just a different rhythm than kind of like the constant grind of other gardening or vegetable farming work. You know, there's different yearly education workshops. It's just something to pay attention to. You do have to like keep your finger on the pulse, but you don't have to grind and do the same thing every day. And this last bit on lean assistance, we're trying to be there for like critical moments of the evolution, but obviously volunteers are there with their finger on the pulse on a much more regular space. So one thing I've evolved to doing is I'll send text messages out to stewards. And this is just a low budget way of having like a push notification on your phone. So in lieu of developing an app or something like that, what I'll do is send out a text and kind of be like the tip of the spear. Like, I'm aware that, you know, we've had some droughty weather. So like, hey, get a bucket of water on the trees or 10 gallons or whatever it is. But I say very explicitly in these texts, do not respond to this. If you respond, even with a thumbs up or a thank you, I will remove you from the text. this is one way out only. I love you, but I will reprimand you if you dare clutter all of our feed and ping constantly. So it's just a one way out. Hey, just a little nudge here. This is a great time for your first spray. Think about that within the next week. To have someone externalize the brain of like a Michael Phillips and to just broadcast to a network of what is needed. Hey, we're in fire blight range. Do XYZ. Like there's lots of things that I think not just this orcharding work, but I think there's other kinds of work that could benefit from just one person kind of giving a little nudge to a community of people. An enjoyable version of like all the political nudges you get. Hey, donate XYZ. It's like, hey, get out there and spray your trees. A lot more purposeful. We can pause right there and kind of wrap up. And if there's other questions that I can answer, I'm happy to talk more. But you can find more information at commonorchard.com. Or you can email me, chris@greenumbrella.org. Sorry, I didn't put the .org on there. But yeah, we'll close with that. Jesse, I turn it back to you.
Thank you so much, Chris. Wow, you are a wealth of information, and you're a living embodiment of this tension that permaculturists, I think, carry within us of the, it all depends, right? Somebody asks you one simple question, and you're like, well, actually, there's like 100 variables that I'm aware of, and I'm probably forgetting about some. So what you just gave us here is clearly a distillation of somebody who's been doing this a long time and has seen some mistakes, both from the human side of things and from the ecological side of things. And the plastic is a perfect example, right? It's like, you've seen it be successful. You understand it has a compromised nature to it vis-a-vis industrial society and all that. But it's also like, I've been a market gardener for about 5 years of my life. And there are just practical realities of like, yo, I cannot be bending down on the ground weeding all the time. I will die. Not literally, but spiritually. So we use a lot of landscape fabric, you know, just to manage vegetable growing. And so I really like that you're using plastic. The only question I'm going to have, because I think this was a great overview and people can talk to you and reach out to you if they have specific questions, is have you played around with ground covers, you know, white clovers, red clovers, these types of things. And that might be a nice sort of a in between plastic and in between like cardboard and mulch, which I agree with you 100%. You're always having to reapply cardboard and wood chips, and it's a huge labor investment. Whereas plastic is like, boom, you're done. The trees are going to be okay. They're not going to be subsumed by the grasses. So have you ever done like a tilling and then a seeding of like some type of ground cover? How did that go in your experience? Or are you open to that idea?
Yeah. So looking at like what natively is the ground cover in our region, my impression or my assessment of it is diversity is the name of the game here in the Midwest. That's why euonymus and honeysuckle, some of these other invasives, are so successful, is because they just have one strategy that just dominates everything. But the strategy that's usually deployed here is diversity itself. So I think the problem that we try to approach things with, like, we'll use clover and we think I'm going to plant one thing. And one thing, unless it's euonymus, you know, unless its strategy in and of itself is domination, it's just not going to work. It will unwind itself in time. So that's why the plastic is like comparable to me to those other kind of plants, like just in strategy. So if you're going to replace that with plants itself, you need to design diversity into the system.
Okay.
And I think like clovers are great. But I've just never seen them stick around long enough to be
so like a perennial dominant ground cover mix would be preferable to like a single white clover or something.
Exactly. So I think it reminds me of the Like, do you know I Heart Huckabees?
Yeah.
There's a scene where he's describing like these little tiny squares, and the other person's pointing out, yeah, but there's all these like cracks between that. Yeah, but there's more squares. I think we need to think about the real estate of these spaces like that. And some of the big blocks are your clumping plants, so like comfrey, yarrow, tansy, elecampane, some of these bigger, broader leafed clumping things that they can take a hit and their roots are strong enough, they'll keep coming back. But then you have to think about the spaces between them. So maybe that's where the clovers and some of the other things go. So as long as you design diversity into the system, and I think something like plastic can give you like some runway to buy you time for those other things to fill out for 2 or 3 years. And then you pull the plastic, and now you've got like a diverse 2 or 3 year old, relatively mature herbaceous layer.
Yes.
You'll be off to the races. And at the end of the day, Bermuda grass is very tough.
Dude,
And if
oh, I
that's
know.
right next to you, like I would never take the plastic off if
Yeah.
Bermuda grass is on site. But yeah, if you kind of form that hedge and that moat, eventually stuff will start to creep in. But in, 20 years, maybe it's okay that there's a random grass here or there.
Another well-nuanced point, I think. That's so great. The other thing I liked about your plastic recommendation is not because with the landscape fabric, it does fray a lot, which was quite an annoyance of me. And then you'd see little pieces here and there, and it's like this is gross. I like that idea that anybody can just go to Home Depot and get the 6 mil thick plastic, and you're not seeing any of that fraying unless you run it over with a lawnmower or something like that. So, well, this.
Yeah, and another point about that, it only works because I'm putting a bunch of other holes in it. If it were a solid sheet of plastic, no water is getting in there. So
Right.
like, again, these were like all these incremental design choices that as you change the system here, it pulls over here.
Yeah.
So as I've eliminated water from getting in, I had to make the holes for all the stuff so that water could get in.
Yep. Again, all good points and all in the it depends, and like don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. I also love your usage of the word legible because I do feel like permaculture suffers sometimes. And I have this at my house, but it's my house, so I'm okay with this wild ecosystem. And it's like awesome. Nobody's like witnessing it out in like some public square or something. The legibility is really, really important. And then, like you say, you have all of a sudden you can walk people all the way up to the full-on wild designs if they're so inclined. So all in all, Chris, this was really great. You knocked it out of the park. Thank you so much for sharing all of this wisdom with everybody. You gave your contact information, so you're okay if people may contact you how to do this in their area. Awesome. Thanks for making yourself available to that too. And yeah, we'll see you around. And thanks again, Chris. Appreciate you very much.
Thank you, Jesse. Have a great day.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye all.
It's nice that PineNet is there to speak up and help network the permaculture movement. It's only capturing a fraction of the movement that are officially involved and are members. So, boy, if PineNet could get all the permacultures, or half of them, or a fourth of them, to all sign up and become working together, PineNet could just really do so much more.
Just every one of my 2,000 students, and all the students that have been through the course, wherever they are in the world, have in some way made a profound impact. And we can do much more if we can link them up and support them strategically. So that's why I'm asking for support from the government.